Nothing on the Bunnell Foundation's Living with Cystic Fibrosis podcast should be considered medical advice. Medical advice can only come from your CF physician. Cystic fibrosis can be a devastating diagnosis, but living with the disease can bring positivity and a new appreciation for each day. From the Bonnell Foundation in Detroit, Michigan, it's the Living with Cystic Fibrosis podcast, sponsored by Vertex Pharmaceutical and Viatris. Here's your host, Laura Bonnell.
Mark Cottrell is from the UK. He has cystic fibrosis and recently turned 40 years old. I love his Instagram presence because he is wonderfully direct about everything cystic fibrosis. You must check him out on IG. And you can see how to follow him in our show notes. Mark lives with his girlfriend, Emma, and her young son, Noah. Mark is a business architect, and he works with lots of different businesses to help them change and improve. And when I started following Mark on social media, I was hooked on his creative videos. He creates videos and music for clients and for his own passion projects. He uses his musical and creative talents to raise awareness about all things cystic fibrosis. So, Mark, it's so wonderful to be able to talk to you. You're joining us from England. Where exactly in England are you?
So I'm somewhere in the Midlands. Most people from other places often know of Manchester, and they usually know of Birmingham. And if you were kind of to go halfway between the two, you'd find me somewhere there. But it's a little place called Stoke-on-Trent, Staffordshire. And I'm in a little town called Cheadle, which is where I've grown up all my life.
Wonderful. It's interesting to talk to you because there is a difference between countries, either on how cystic fibrosis is handled or certainly how, you know, we deal with insurance and things like that. But
yeah,
I think I was following you before you did our CF film awareness, and we saw your film, which was fantastic. But I love your whole attitude about CF and your honesty, vulnerability, your badassness about it. I love you're not messing around. Like, you're just telling the truth. I love that.
Thank you.
I love the way, you know, you do your videos. When did you get so vocal about talking about CF? Were you always this way?
Not at all. Not at all. So I've actually found that, like many others, I've kept CF quite hidden for the majority of my life. So I'm actually 40 years old as we speak today, recently turned, which, you know, is crazy and quite surprising to me and my family, you know. But I mean, you know of all the advancements that have been made over recent years. And as a kid, we wouldn't have believed that. But yeah, as a kid growing up with CF, I was not interested in sharing that story. Or I think, like many others, you can feel very alone in this world when it comes to your health growing up. You're the only one who's having to, you know, put all of this time into things that, let's face it, none of us want to be doing. The effort involved in just managing CF when you're doing okay, you know, and you're on that level playing field and things aren't too bad, it's huge. You know, add a complication on top of that, like a lung infection or whatever, and that effort, that treatment regime, it only goes up and you're asked more of. So I think as a kid growing up, like most kids, you know, I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be like everybody else. And I was kind of doing everything I could, I think, to prove that I was like everyone else. I was very, very competitive in my nature, because as a child growing up with CF, you're told about all of the things that you perhaps should take care of, and that you can't breathe like everybody else around you, and that maybe you should take things easier than one or two others. So, of course, my competitive nature, which definitely comes from my parents, it was kind of my goal to prove some of that wrong in some respects. And, you know, if I could win a race at school, then I would be trying my best to win that race, rather than perhaps racing, you know, in athletics isn't for you. Well, absolutely it was. And I wanted to prove that it doesn't matter about what you guys say. Not only can I compete, but I can win, you know. So no, I didn't talk about it. I did my treatments. I had a very good upbringing in that. I was very adherent to everything that I was told to do. I did as I was told by my parents. got my treatments done. But that was it. That's where the conversation ended. I would then, you know, forget about it, if you like, and until the next time that I was called in to do physiotherapy. Looking back again as a child, in my mind, I was okay in terms of CF. No major problems that I can remember. I'm sure if you spoke to my parents, they'd tell you some horror stories about various times when I ended up in hospital, and particularly the first time I ended up having to go in and stay in for a prolonged period of time. But my memory is that as a kid, I was doing okay, you know, very active, very sporty, as I say. Fast forward as you get to my 20s, and that's really when noticeably things started to really grab hold of me. I was slowing down, regardless of my attitude and willingness to push forward and push through it. And I think it was, I went such a long time without having to have a stay in hospital. And the first time that that then happened was in my kind of mid-20s, I would say, at which point then it was a huge reality check. And from there, the decline continued. And of course, the worse I got, well, of course, now I don't want to share any of this, you know, I'm no longer this guy that can kind of compete and win and all these different things, far from it. So why would I be sharing this story? Which, with hindsight, I regret somewhat. Fast forward to my 20s. And again, that first time that I then ended up in hospital for a good couple of weeks having IV antibiotics, huge reality check. I was no longer in that position where I could just, you know, do my everyday treatments and get by. Those treatments were asking more of me in terms of time. You know, so rather than a 20-minute, half an hour treatment session a couple of times a day, I was starting to find that, well, there now is something there to try and get rid of, and that's going to take a lot more effort. And sadly, 30 minutes ain't going to cut it, you know. That was ramping up and up and up and seemingly had no ceiling, you know, the older I got. And as you know, the treatments associated with the CF have just kind of come out of nowhere in some respects. And we've had huge improvements with symptoms now. And I think it was that point when I reached, what would it have been? I think it was 38, a couple of years ago. I was, you could kind of call it lucky or unlucky. I think lucky. But I was in that bracket of being unwell enough to try to apply for a compassionate kind of access to some of the new treatments that were available, even though they weren't yet licensed for use over here in the UK. And you have to go through one or two tests, meet a certain criteria in order to be considered. And I was certain at this point that I'd be the right candidate. And there are other complications which we can go into, I'm happy to talk about. But the short version is that I kind of demanded, really, my CF team put me forward for this.
For the specialty drug, are you talking about? Okay.
Correct, yeah. And thankfully, the application was accepted. I gained access to those specialty drugs and things turned around. You know, you'll be very familiar with that story of overnight, things turned around. You know, I'd gone from not doing, but needing 6 hours worth of airway clearance treatment per day to, I don't think I even need any right now. I feel that clear and that, you know, full of air. Obviously, the treatments continued and we check, but that was what I woke up to, you know, a day or two after starting this new treatment.
I mean, it's just unbelievable how fast it worked.
Scarily fast.
Right. In one daughter, you know, this drug changes the underlying condition of cystic fibrosis. It is not a cure, but it does unbelievable things.
If that's not a cure, it certainly feels like one. For I think particularly for those of us who are a bit older, you know, we've got to that stage where symptoms are really, you know, dragging us down now.
Yeah.
And our treatment demand is through the roof. You know, I say 6 hours for treatment per day. That's only because I was putting a cap on the time, you know. I was doing two sessions or three per day, and it'd be a good 2 or 3 hours per session, just lying down and trying to get rid of this stuff off my lungs.
And you're an active person.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
not
completely.
Like you were sitting on the couch. You are, as they say, ripped. Like people can look on your Instagram and see your beautiful body. I mean, you are lifting, I don't even know how much, but you are lifting all this weight. I mean, you're doing incredible things. So it's not like you were just, you know, sitting around not working out.
Yeah, and I think that's, it's a bit of the two conflicting things almost, aren't they? You know, you could describe this awful condition that is zapping the life out of you, that is exhausting, that demands 6 hours of my time every day in order to just clear my lungs. Yet, on the other side, I'd still got that determination to do the things I enjoy fundamentally, because I enjoy, you know, that aspect of sport and staying healthy or fit on that side of the side of things. But the two things, you know, how can I say to someone that I've got this horrible, exhausting, chronic illness, but for them to see me in the gym the following day, as you say, squatting with 110 kilograms on my back or whatever it is, the two don't seem to fit together, but actually they do, you know, and we can still attempt to do some of these things. You know, not everyone's the same,
right?
You know, and that's a varying scale completely, but it's something I've always done. It just so happened that prior to these specialist drugs, my ability to attack those sessions and to progressively overload my body in order to demand and stimulate growth and improvement and all those things was becoming much harder. So right now I'm training 6 days a week, loving it, not getting out of breath. I'm running three of those sessions per week and the rest is weights. I can still go for long walks with the dog and the family. And that's all without anywhere close to the level of, in terms of time, the treatment that I was doing prior to. But of course, when you're in that state of, let's face it, being really poorly, because that's what I was, even though I wouldn't have defined it as that at the time, You have to pick your battles. And my thing was, well, work is priority. I never want to quit work, although it was getting to a stage where I was having to request that I could work from home more often than perhaps, you know, your average guy. And this was long before the pandemic, in order so that I could do extra treatments at my desk kind of thing. Because of course, we don't want to be spluttering and coughing and doing airway clearance in a kind of office full of people. So yeah, I would pick my battles. Work was a priority. Let's do your best to stay in a full-time position. Not just because I don't want to accept that kind of CS taking over. Yes, there's an element of that, but because I enjoyed it. You know, who doesn't want to work and contribute and earn money and do great things? So that came first. The second one was, you know, you could argue treatment comes first, but work is my priority outside of that. After that, what exercise can I get in without it, you know, completely exhausted me? So I would try and do my best to get at least three sessions in per week. But as I say, there's some weeks when I was too ill to do so. But come, you know, the situation where I got access to these new drugs and you've got this new lease of life. And as we said, it's kind of an overnight thing. It's almost like you've been held back, a bit like a catapult, and then someone's let go, you know, and you can now progress. And it feels now, going into the gym now feels like it did, you know, when I was 18 and I was just getting into this. And you're seeing all these newbie gains, as they call it, whereby your strength goes through the roof. Your enjoyment of being in that place is just skyrocketing. And I think it was a combination of those things and the fact that I was one of the very few early recipients of this drug that I thought, why wouldn't I share this, you know? Why wouldn't I? It felt wrong to me that I'm one of the few that has this. It needs to be in the hands of more people. So how do we do that? Well, surely we could start by sharing how great this thing is. And that was kind of my mindset in March 2020, that was. So yeah, it was that moment really where I started to say, okay, let's share this story. Because it should all be something that I'm proud of. And looking back, it is. But at the time when you are desperately unwell, you don't feel proud, you know, you just feel, and I don't want to share this. I really don't. Getting very emotional there about that. But
of course,
you'll be very familiar with that transformation. And that's what it does to you, you know. I still can't believe it. Apologies.
I understand. It worked for one of my daughters, and the other one, it only worked for 9 days. But in those 9 days before she had a severe reaction, she saw her health increase in 9 days. So I understand why you're crying.
After a lifetime of gradual decline, chipping away at you day after day.
And as a parent, I cried. I cried when it was approved here in the United States. I was at a conference. It was before the pandemic. It was October 2019. And then I sobbed when Emily had to go off of it, because it gave me hope and a feeling of, my girls are going to live long lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully she can get desensitized to it and try it again. But I understand the emotion that goes with this. This is huge.
And I never get tired of telling the story, you know. I'm sure one or two people who not in the CF kind of realm think, okay, Mark, you've you know, we've heard it now kind of thing, move on. But no, because...
Never.
When you've spent that many years climbing that hill and then all of a sudden, like... For want of a better phrase, I can just take a breath.
Right.
It is that, you know, there's nothing more kind of, I don't think you could ever get that sense of euphoria unless you'd gone through so much. So that's what it was like. And that's why I thought, do you know what? It wasn't a conscious, right, from this moment, I'm now going to do X, Y, or Z and share my story. But I think it just started with an initial piece of writing, quite light writing. And I just kind of sat down. I thought, I'll just put some of my thoughts and feelings down on paper. That then turned into a post. I posted it, you know, on my personal Facebook, and the reaction was great. And that then led me to other people in the CF community. And our local kind of charities picked up on it. And you're kind of like, this is great. You know, why wouldn't I continue to give other people hope that this thing's coming along, you know?
Yeah. And when you did the video about the triple combo drug, my husband and I, we watched it over so many times and got chills every time. And as many times as I've watched it, if I were to watch it again, I would feel the same way. It's kind of what you're talking about as far as emotion. It is your hope for the future. This is life-changing. It is
completely.
27 years with Molly and 24 years with Emily of such emotional and physical challenges getting through this hurdle or this lung infection. So I totally...
Yeah. I mean, I often think that kind of to a point as kids, I often think that parents have it in some ways even worse, you know, than the child themselves to a point. Because as kids, you know, we didn't know any different. We just do as we're told, and we know that our parents have got our best interests at heart. So we listen to them. But yeah, to be a parent going through that and to think back when my parents were first given that diagnosis in 1982, when, you know, there's no internet, there's no Laura or Mark online talking about what this means and access to information and insight and support. None of that was there, you know. So, yeah, I think, you know, my respect goes out to all parents who've dealt with that, dealing with that, new parents, even though, you know, we've got access to these new drugs.
Right.
It's a very scary time, right?
Thanks. Yeah, it is. And, you know, another thing we connected on, too, was, okay, so it was approved first in the United States. And
yes,
my daughter, as you know, Molly's living abroad there in London, England. So she can't have it legally.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And we actually debated, do you move home? Because it's legal here.
Yeah.
And it was a tough conversation because her life is there in England. It's her, everything is there. And I wanted her to move home for this drug. And she was like, going to have to wait till it's approved there.
How was she doing at that stage health-wise?
She was doing well.
Yeah.
She was doing well. She had an exacerbation. It was the first time she was admitted to the hospital in the UK.
Okay.
And that was a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
Oh, great experience, honestly. Even though she had a lung, they just do things a little bit differently. And they have a different word, I guess, for PICC line. Because I kept saying, are you getting a PICC line? She's like, I keep asking them that, and they...
It's a funny one, yeah, that one. So for my entire kind of childhood, they were referred to as long lines, which were kind of traditionally something that you would put in the kind of forearm vein somewhere around here, or maybe at the elbow, and it would go up the arm. Mm-hmm. But I know, yeah, particularly for me, I can go into my vascular issues. That was one of the huge, scary things that I was facing prior to the triple combo. And yeah, I know at one point when I was kind of running out of access, really, vascularly, and PICC lines then became an option, which is, I think, traditionally a little bit deeper and, you know, much further below the surface than what I'd been used to with the long lines. But
and anyone that doesn't know, it goes in really between your elbow and your shoulder, I guess, is the only thing in the midst there. And then it drops the line close to your heart. So the IV meds are pumped in there.
Yeah. I think IVs, again, in our community, IVs, you kind of just, I'm going in for IVs, or I'm due some IVs. And it's kind of a throwaway thing of no big deal, IVs. I know to some people it really is, because it can be a traumatic experience. But when you've gone through that process time and time and time again, and obviously by the time I was, you know, mid to late 20s, I'd had countless, you know, IVs, not all of them involving an admission into hospital, but it must be hundreds, you know, we must be talking hundreds.
Yeah, and, it's a lot.
And you do desensitize to it. Oh, yeah. And it becomes this, IVs, but no big deal kind of thing. And I can remember being at school, at work, sorry, in my early 20s, and I had to have a chat with my boss and say, you know, health's not great at the moment, but I'm feeling okay, health's not great, so we're just going to do some routine IVs. Don't worry, I'm going to do them from home, so all I need from you is a day off to go and get the procedure done, get the line fitted, and then can we sort somewhere at work a room so that I can administer the drugs during my working day? And they were kind of getting into it, and like, just exactly what do you mean? You know, even the term IVs wasn't something that they were familiar with. And so then you spell it out. Well, actually, I'm having a line put into my vein. It will stay there permanently for at least a couple of weeks. And then I will need to inject 9 syringes full of medication 3 times a day. And obviously one of those times I need to do here at work. And they were, and mine was blown, you know, why would you be coming to work at like this? By all means, take the time off, you know, do what you need to do, get healthy, come. But again, from our point of view, we don't want life to stop, you know.
Right.
This ain't an excuse that we're trying to get some time off work. This is just, if anything, an inconvenience that's getting in the way of all of this stuff that we want to be doing.
And it's exhausting.
Yeah, it really can be.
Emotionally, physically.
Yeah, completely. But I can remember the boss that sort of thinking, are you mad? Why would you be doing this? Why, you know, just have the time off. And I didn't, you know, where I could, I would continue with life, but then manage these things that I would have to do around it. And I think it was that process of going through so many of these that it became, well, just IVs. But to everyone else, when they heard the detail, it was like, wow, well, you know, and they had a lot of respect for me for that kind of mindset with it, you know.
And that reminds me of, you know, your videos. I was going over them again today. The video about CF work advice that you had, I liked that. You know, when do you tell your employer, or when do you tell someone you're dating? I mean, all these issues, and or maybe they're not issues, but, you know, things that you've talked about.
Yeah.
So when did you decide? And then it's the other thing that I loved, you know, I think it was 5 things you shouldn't say to somebody with CF.
And
a couple of them, I'm like, oh my gosh, my girls are like, I wish I could be that thin, you know, that
classic.
One. And you don't look sick, the invisible disease, like, which you were kind of just talking about.
Yeah, I think the work one, again, you know, looking back, I was very much need to know basis, you know, are you my family member, kind of best mate, doctor? If the answer's no to those, then you don't get to know, you don't need to know, which I don't believe is the right approach these days. You know, I'm looking at this with hindsight now. But at the time it was, you don't need to know. It's my thing. I'm dealing with it. I don't need your support, don't want it, don't want to talk about it. The more I take this approach, the more it doesn't exist. You know, I'll do what I need to do to keep it in check and to keep things going, but don't ask me any questions. And that was my approach. And again, I don't think that's the right way to go about it necessarily, but everyone's different. And some people need that, and they need to be open, and they need that support and help, and they want to have conversations. But for me, it was a no-go area. So, and actually, there was a worry with work. You know, I genuinely thought at one stage that, you know, if there's two applications there and very similar experience, qualifications and what have you, but one of them talks about CF, and then they Google it and they get all this information about hospitalizations and IVs like we've just been talking about. I genuinely used to think, well, as an employer, they're probably just going to take the other guy. It's an easier shot. You know, the two guys, they match up on paper, but this just sounds like hassle and wait and nah, it's not for me kind of thing. And I honestly believe that, which is crazy. We don't live in that world anymore now anyway. You know, I think things like that have come a long, long way in the last decade regardless. But that was my worry. So I always took the approach of, they'll find out when they find out. Let me get the job first. And sure enough, they do, because you can't hide CF all the time. You know, if you have a chest infection, someone eventually is going to like say, are you okay? You're coughing quite a bit. And, you know, you will need time off at some point, I'm sure. And I did.
Well, and now because of COVID, everyone's worried about the coughs, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think in some ways they've had a little insight into, you know, at least the worry associated with catching bugs and things that we've, you know, that we've known and had to deal with our entire lives. But yeah, I was always the, they'll find out when they need to find out. Don't have the conversation up front. It might hold you back. But I think there's a lot of amazing things that can come out of being a bit more brave than I was, being a bit more open. Because again, with regards to friendships in the CF community, I didn't want it. If anything, as a teenager, I always thought that it's not going to catch me. You know, I'm going to outrun it. I'm going to out exercise it, or, you know, I'm far too fit to for CF to catch me up kind of thing. Therefore, I don't want to get close to other people with CF, because then if I see them going through horrible times, bad times, or even worse, and we lose them, what's that going to do to me and my sense of self? And I wasn't prepared to take that risk. But again, with hindsight, it's the wrong thing to do. You know, look at how many amazing things come out of connecting with someone who understands you. So yeah, I think you learn those lessons eventually. It took me a long time. It took me a very long time. And it's great to see so much younger people now being far more open and brave than I ever was. So it's lovely to, you know, contribute to that community of conversation.
But it's also because of where we came from and how fast things are now changing. So,
yeah.
I mean, the work you're doing now, tell us a little bit about, so you're a business architect, tell us what that entails. And then you've got these beautiful guitars behind you, you know, you sing, you're doing these videos. Like I said, you really are so badass when you do all your, you know, Instagram things. I really encourage people to check out your Instagram and see what you're all about, because you're so inspiring to parents and to other people who have cystic fibrosis and the CF community in general. But, you know, tell us a little bit about everything you're doing.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, by the way. That's lovely of you to say. So I'll start with music, because that's probably where my interest in kind of creative work started, right? And I can remember as a young guy, my mum played the guitar beautifully. You know, she'd got the acoustic guitar that you can probably just about see at the back there.
Mm-hmm.
That's my mum's.
Wow.
So I've got these lovely memories of my mum just finger picking to me and my sister Lisa. So of course, as a kid, you see something cool like that. I want to go. And my mum quite rightly said, well, let's get you some proper, you know, lessons, and you can do that kind of thing. So I did, me and my sister did classical guitar lessons for a number of years when we were kids. And it just kind of fizzled out. You know, I got so far with it. Lisa got so far. We did a couple of like recitals and different things that we've got some great clips of. But I think football and sport kind of took over, and I kind of left music behind for a while. And then I think I was in my last year or second to last year of high school. And obviously at high school, there's various cliques, you know, people into football or basketball or, you know, people in the music room. And at our school, we just had this great new music suite built. And slowly but surely, my lunch times then just ended up me hanging around with some of the cool people who could play instruments. And one guy in particular, a guy called Andy, he was an amazing drummer. And all of a sudden I got this hook for, oh, I've got to be a drummer. So that was the next thing. And it was like, you know, me and my mate banging drums every lunchtime at school. And then I saw a couple of guys playing lead guitar. I was like, oh, that looks even cooler. And they tend to stand at the front of the stage, you know. So that was it. Then I finally kind of, I sold my drums or swapped them for a guitar. And that was then where my love of the guitar started. So joined a couple of bands, and one of the bands did really, really well when I was in my teens. So we did a showcase for Columbia Records, which is a huge record company here at the time. We got signed by another record company, and we were on this kind of path of recording an album, and it all looked to be like, this is going somewhere. And we couldn't believe it. We were like 15, thinking we're going to be pop stars or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
For various other reasons that I won't go into and bore you with, it didn't happen. But music, ever since then, I've loved it. And since then, I've been a DJ, used to work in a few nightclubs in my 20s. I've always been producing music. So what you can't see here is like my studio, a couple of speakers and instruments and audio interfaces and things. So friends come over, we write, we create. I go to my friend's studio. He runs a studio all week called Inspire Music. We write for other artists and, you know, we record music. And it's just, it's one of those beautiful things that it doesn't, like, of course the output matters, what the song sounds like matters, but the process itself is such an enjoyable thing to, an enjoyable way to spend your time. And all of us have kind of fallen in love with that. So that's the kind of music thing. It's just been a part of my life now for more years than it hasn't, you know, and it's something that I'll never let go of. You know, just having the guitars there. If I've got 20 minutes of doing nothing, then sure enough, one of those will end up on my lap and I'll have a bit of a noodle around, and it's therapeutic. It's you can escape, and it's creative. Sometimes you do that and all of a sudden you've got a song, and that song ends up getting recorded and you can release it, and it's just an amazing thing to do. But work-wise, that's kind of, I would put that in my creative part of my life, and along with that, shoot videos, not just about CF and my experience with CF, but I shoot videos for clients, whether it be music videos or interviews and that kind of thing. But I would call all of that my kind of side interests, passion projects, if you like. My main job, as you said, is I'm a business architect, and that involves me helping, you know, taking on temporary contracts with companies and going in and helping them to improve. And that could be kind of from a regulatory standpoint, like with data protection and those kind of things, where a new rule is kind of placed and they've got to now meet a new set of standards in order to do business. Or it could be more of a transformational thing where they're saying, you know, our competitors are kind of catching us. Maybe we need to look into new markets or new products and services, or the app's getting a bit tired now. Maybe we need to update the app. And what I do is help them to articulate that vision of where they want to be and then define the kind of requirements that will help them to get there. So I go in for 6 months or sometimes 12, help them define that, get them on the way, deliver it, and then I'll move on to another company. And it's great because I'm my own company. I get to choose the projects that I'm interested in. I can choose how long I work, where I work. It means I can say, well, I'm going to keep my Fridays free for the creative side of things. And so far, fingers crossed, you know, touch wood, it's worked out really well. And I enjoy it, which is the main thing, right?
It is. And it gives you flexibility.
Yeah.
And so do you just also, in regard to your videos and things that you post on Instagram, is that just whenever you're feeling something, you decide to do those?
Yeah, obviously time's a big one. And during the kind of first year of the COVID pandemic, 2020, everyone seemingly had a lot more time on their hands, right? And for me, not knowing anything about this, and like most, is this going to be deadly for us in the CF community? Is it something that we need to... That lack of knowledge was scary. We had no idea, you know, and I certainly wasn't going to test that. So I was fortunate enough to be in a position to say, right, I'll just put a brakes on the work for now, take some time off so that I'm not, you know, forcing myself into these businesses and interacting with people when it's a little bit scary to be doing so. And obviously it was before restrictions started to really kick in. So I took a step back, and obviously now I've got a lot more free time as a result of that, and would then start to create. Right now I'm back in that work sphere again. And yes, we're still working from home, but of course my time's taken up with the day job most of the time. But yeah, for me, it's about inspiration, right? Something will inspire you. I'll watch something, I'll see something, I'll hear a story. And then it, right, okay, I'm going to create something. And sometimes, you know, I've got more projects on my desktop that are unfinished than are finished, because like with music, you can pick up the guitar and start writing something, and it just kind of ends up in the kind of digital bin, and it goes nowhere. And that often happens with things that I set about writing or creating from, you know, with the videos. But I'm usually inspired by something. My Fridays are my days to create, so I'll tend to set aside a bit of time and go, right, what am I going to do? And I've got a bit of a process, because ideas come wherever, right? You can't guarantee that you're going to get a great idea on a Friday. So I've got a bit of a process whereby if an idea springs, I've got a bit of software on my phone that I can capture the idea in a little card. And then I've got like this process in a bit of software on my desktop where I can go, right, that's the raw idea. On my Friday, then I can look in the bucket of ideas and go, right, today I'll work on that one and flesh it out a little bit more. Maybe I'll write the script or whatever it is, and then just move it along the board each Friday to a point where eventually it lands in the published folder.
Oh, that's great.
And that tends to be how it works. But I think I go in phases, you know. Sometimes I'm creating four or five things a week, and other times it's a couple of weeks or a couple of months without anything. But I guess that's life.
It's definitely a process of getting organized in all the other demands that you have on your life, your family and work and everything. And one of the other things I wanted to ask you was, I mean, I consider you an advocate, obviously, and doing so many things. What else, you know, you and I and the other woman's name escapes me right now.
Sue.
Yeah, we were working on kind of health equity across the world. We were, you know, starting that. But even with this triple combo, as we talked about, it was approved in the US. It wasn't in the UK. I think it was a year, year and a half later.
Yeah.
And in Canada, they're still having to approve it in every province.
Yeah.
So it still isn't even approved there. And this is something we talked about wanting to change. In Egypt, there's not even a chance of them getting it because they can barely get enzymes there. I mean, it's a huge topic sort of to wrap up with, but we have so much work to do, right? We have...
Completely.
It's overwhelming almost to think about it.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. And I think two sides to it, I think. On one hand, like me, when I was one of the first in the UK to get hold of this, you kind of toying with these couple of emotions. One of euphoria that I described before around, wow, thank God, you know, unbelievable that I'm lucky enough to be in this position. But on some level, a bit of guilt with that as well, because you see all these other people who, you know, the second they can see that you're doing well and it's because of something tangible, it's not just you falling lucky with your symptoms. Of course, they reach out and they want information. How did you get it? What was it you said? How did the application process work? And so, of course, I started to get this from people in the UK. And there is that element of guilt to think, well, why do I deserve it? You know, just because I'm older and just because my symptoms have got slightly worse than yours. That kind of, it puts aside their struggle that they're still and will keep going through unless we do something about this. But broader than that, when the UK did finally license the triple combo and, you know, far more people now have got access to it, you're then on a bigger stage. You know, you're putting yourselves out there as a group, as a community of, you know, who are thankful for this transformation. And of course, then you're attracting Canada and New Zealand and Australia and various other places, but also the other areas of the world that we don't necessarily think of straight away. You mentioned Egypt there. You know, I've had people from India contact me, Africa even, and it's usually a parent, and they just ask you for help, and you kind of sat there thinking, well, what can I do? You know, what can I do? And I don't think there's an answer, but there's always something, whether that be just for them to know that they've got your support, you know, in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they're doing what they can from their point in the world and from their standpoint on social media, for example, sharing their stories, trying to raise their own level of awareness. So we could get involved in that. We can help them. We can share their stories with other people. But I think you're right. Fundamentally, as a community, as a global community, there's probably more that we should and could be doing. So I think it's difficult because initially we do just think, well, how can we solve this? If all the greatest politicians in the world, the world's leaders can't solve this, what can we do? But actually look back at history, look back at the first realm of specialist drugs that came along, you know, I'm thinking here in the UK, we wouldn't have got access to those if it wasn't for passionate parents on social media and individuals who were shouting about their cause. And so I do think these things can snowball, and it would be very easy, I think, now for us who are receiving this and who have gone through that transformation to put our feet up, you know, enjoy life and kind of go, yeah, got mine. Good luck. But I don't think anyone thinks that. I think anyone within the CF community would do. If they thought there was something that they could do to help, they would, and they do.
Yeah.
You know, because you can see people sharing all this information. It's just, what else can we do? What's the next level up beyond, you know, getting involved and sharing and all those different things? And one of the things I think that is amazing is you see people who are truly, truly and deeply involved in shouting for these causes, like yourself, like Sue, who we mentioned before, like there's a guy called Edward Lee from New Zealand. Like, he was lucky enough to gain access to the triple combo very early, and they still don't have it, but he's on the news, he's in the papers, he's all over Twitter, he's all over LinkedIn, he's sharing stories of different individuals, and he's helping to pull all of this information together. And it's inspiring to see that someone who is a bit older, who's gone through all these different things, isn't just going, right, time to enjoy life now.
Right.
Yes, he's doing a bit of that, but he's also fighting for the other guy, you know. So I think we can all do a bit of that, and everyone can benefit.
I agree. And we are one community. And I think the CF community is so good at sharing and supporting each other and working on it. It just is so frustrating that to get it figured out in the US, in the UK, and they're working on it in Canada, that it doesn't work for everyone, but, you know, different governments, different ministers of health or ministries of health and all of that plays in also. Before I ask you what you're looking toward in the future and everything, is there a song you can play, a short one? Can you grab a guitar, or is that too much?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot now, Laura.
I know. I just keep looking at those guitars like, well,
I don't know how well it would translate, you know, if I started to plug electric guitars in.
No problem. We will have people go to your Instagram, and we need to write a CF mom song.
Okay.
And when I say we, I mean you. You can you do the music. CF moms have a lot to say. We'll have to figure something out. I'll have to talk to a bunch of CF moms, and then we'll get your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm hoping to share some new music later this year, because it's been a while. It's nearly 2 years since I did the Thousand Years song. And I've started writing again more recently, and I've got a couple of ideas for new songs. So I'm hoping that later this year I can release some bits and bobs. So I'll let you know on that. But yeah, if there's a creative project that we can collab on, always open.
Absolutely. I'm going to be thinking about it. What is your hope for the future in any direction, be it advocacy or medications, cure, whatever, I guess for the CF community and for yourself?
Yeah, I think from a CF community point of view, we've talked about the global access issue. Of course, we all hope that we can solve that, you know, and that we know that these things exist. We know how transformational they are. Why can't we get everyone on it? Who's eligible? That to me is fundamental. We've got to get to that stage, and anything that we can do to help, you know, we're here for it. Beyond that, you'll know that there's kind of a section of this group of people with CF who aren't eligible for this for genetic reasons. And that to me should then be the focus, or in tandem with global access should also be the focus. We have a charity here in the UK, and they reached out to ask what I thought. You know, they have a CF week every year, and what should the theme be this year? And they're asking lots of different people what they thought. And for me, it should be that 10% group.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we not talking to them more, asking for their story? Because we've seen so many different stories about people who have experienced the triple combo, which is great. I don't want that to stop. But let's also get involved with this other group of people now who may start to feel a bit left behind, you know, and I'd love to see more in that space in terms of sharing stories, but also obviously from a drugs point of view, from a treatment point of view, which I know things are in the pipeline. So it'll be amazing to see some of those things come to fruition and to see then these transformational stories, fingers crossed, of those people who've not been able to benefit from the triple combo. That's my hope. I've got no doubt that it'll happen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think the triple combo took us by surprise in terms of how quickly it kind of emerged and became this huge thing.
Right.
And I've got no doubt that something will come along in that space for this other group of people. So I'm eagerly awaiting news of that.
So that 10% is because they have rare mutations.
Yeah.
And that's why. And also included in that, I would say, are people like my daughter, Emily, who the triple combo didn't work for.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So there is a group of people, and then people of color who have been underdiagnosed.
Yeah.
And seem to have, you know, this Hispanic community as well, who have more rare mutations as well. So
definitely. And you hear of whispers of future treatments that are not kind of gene specific. And I think that, you know, we're holding a lot of hope in that sense. And I did a bit of work chatting to a guy who is working in gene editing as well. And that's a whole other realm of, wow, you know, that could come along, that he believes could come along within the next 10 years or so. And I'd encourage any of your kind of listeners to go and have a watch of that interview. You know, on my Instagram, I interviewed a guy, and there's probably four or five, maybe six episodes where I ask the real questions, you know, how much is it going to cost and when?
Right.
And obviously some of the things he could answer, really good insights into how it works and what it is specifically. So yeah, there's a lot of hope, and I know that's important. And again, thinking back to my parents back in the day, there was none. You know, I think 1989 or whatever it was when we located and pinpointed the CF gene, that was a moment of real inspiration and hope. But then it was kind of tumbleweed from there onwards, seemingly, for my parents, you know. Whereas now it does feel like there's a lot more hope than there once was. So I think we're all excited for that to come to some kind of fruition, whichever that is, you know. Excited for that. Beyond that, for me, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, you know. I think the amazing thing of going through such an incredible transformation is you feel like you've been gifted time. And I know we never really knew how long we'd have.
Mm-hmm.
But if you'd asked me when I was 35, 36, I might not have thought I'd reach 40, yet here I am. And now it just feels like that question doesn't really matter, you know, which is amazing. I don't care to think about how long I may have or not, because it doesn't feel like it's a pressing, imminent thing that I need to worry about. And with that, I get time with my family and time to do creative projects and to talk to you and to do all these amazing things that define life, you know, to just enjoy our time here. So no major plans in terms of conquering the world or anything like that, but just to enjoy that time and never forget how it could have gone, you know, really important to me.
Right. And what a beautiful way to end this podcast as well. Thank you for everything that you're doing and how you're raising awareness about cystic fibrosis and for sharing your story. And everybody definitely needs to check it out. It's in the show notes. Mark Cotterill, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yeah,
did I get
that's
that?
Good.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we appreciate your story and you.
Thank you. Thanks ever so much.
And happy birthday, 40. I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a big one. We had a great celebration. Just so thankful to be able to do it, you know. And thank you for today. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Laura.
The original music in this podcast is performed by Kevin Allen.
It's not complicated.
Who happens to have cystic fibrosis.
We all got our worries and fears. I know what's got you frustrated. But loving you is so all right.
This has been the Living with Cystic Fibrosis podcast. For more information and to learn more about the Bonnell Foundation, visit our website at thebonnellfoundation.org. That's the B-O-N-N-E-L-L foundation.org. This podcast was sponsored by Vertex Pharmaceutical, The Science of Possibility, and Viatris. It was produced by Jag and Detroit Podcasts. Follow our show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now.